I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Joe Biden has run for president three times, and last night he accepted his party's nomination to challenge President Trump for the White House.
Here and now, I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together. And make no mistake, united we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America.
Last night capped the end of a four-day virtual convention that made history by nominating a woman of color, Kamala Harris, to be vice president. It also featured speeches from heavy hitters like Barack and Michelle Obama, who aimed their pointed criticisms directly at the president, rank-and-file Democrats, Republicans, and some young up-and-comers in the Democratic Party, including our guest Malcolm Kenyatta. He's state representative of Pennsylvania's 181st District, which is here in Philadelphia. Welcome, Kenyatta. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back. Always glad to join you.
I'm very good. And your segment was pre-taped. You had a chance to watch yourself on TV. What was that like?
you know what? It was an incredibly moving experience, you know, to wake up the next day, right, and see myself and my partner on the front page of the Inquirer looking at me, give these remarks. But I think what's more impactful, I hope, is that there are a number of young Black kids and young queer kids who aren't saying, oh my God, look what Malcolm did, but who are rather saying, look what I can do.
I'm curious, it was you and 16 others, so-called, you know, rising stars in the Democratic Party. Why do you think you were selected? And did you write your own comments about Biden and the party?
So I think a part of it is what Joe Biden has said, that he sees himself as this transitional figure and that he has deep responsibility from his perspective and investing in that next generation of leadership. You saw it with the selection of Senator Harris, and you saw it when you looked at that group, a broad, diverse group from across the country, from across our party, who are all deeply committed not only to beating Donald Trump, which is the floor to what we need to do, but really taking all those great things we say about America, many of them written right here in Philadelphia in a hot summer like this one, and making them real in our lifetime. And so, you know, I think that he was looking to get a broad cross-cutting segment of the Democratic Party, and I was really, really pleased to, you know, to share remarks with folks, many of whom I know and have deep respect for.
Pennsylvania is often described as a battleground state. It certainly has been in the past and still described that way, even though it looks like Biden is ahead by a couple of percentage points so far. One of the messages from the convention was vote, 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 vote. Why do Democrats need so much pressure to vote, do you think?
I think because we have a president right now who doesn't have a record of success to run on. And so I think he and his campaign are doing everything possible to, of course, shirk responsibility, which is, you know, Trump's go-to, but additionally to try to lessen folks' faith in the democratic process. And that is, you know, of all the things that this president has done, all the weakening of our institutions, his constant attack against the post office, against the voting process more broadly, is one of the things that he will be remembered for and certainly not fondly. And so I think the message is, irrespective of the noise that's coming from Donald Trump and from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue right now, we all have to utilize our most powerful tool in a democratic republic, and that's the option to vote.
Biden outline four crises that he sees facing the country: the pandemic, the economic crisis, the need for racial justice, and the threats of climate change. Looking at people in your district, and I should say this is a poor district within a poor city, the poorest large city in the country, what does the vice president, now the nominee, what does he offer your constituents?
So I think one of the best things about Joe Biden, you know, having really gotten to know him, you know, I endorsed him on the day he announced. And one of the reasons I did was because of his capacity to lead as well as listen. And I got to talk to him when he was here in Philadelphia in great detail about the concerns of folks here in my district, the gun violence that we're seeing at record levels, as well as really the crisis of deep poverty in communities. And I think that he has done incredibly well in crafting bold, big proposals, you know, so many of which are under this Build Back Better framework that speaks to the types of historic investments we need to make in affordable housing and in home ownership and building up Black businesses, 41% of which some studies say may never reopen.
Wow.
Because of the president's mismanagement of this pandemic. Investing in our education, as you well know, and I think you talked about on your show, some of the issues in our schools with the asbestos and the mold. So he understands the multiplicity of challenges that face communities like North Philly. You know, he's been here. And as I said, I've been able to talk to him in detail about so many of these challenges. And that ability to listen and be collaborative in your approach to governing is something that has not only made him a good candidate and nominee who's been able to unite the party, but I think it's going to make him a president that's able to unite this country.
And final question to you, and I hear it from what you're saying about Joe Biden, but I also heard it from watching the convention, is that the country seems to need some kind of empathizer in chief. Is that how you see Joe Biden?
So, I mean, you just look at the contrast. Donald Trump is dangerously dumb, and his inability to lead in this moment has led to the loss of lives and livelihoods. Joe Biden understands what it means to be in a working class family. He understands what it means to lose people that matter to him. And that experience is what so many Americans are experiencing right now. It's what the 7,000 plus families here in Pennsylvania who've lost someone to this pandemic, it's what they're feeling. And it's what the hundreds of thousands of folks across the Commonwealth and the millions across the country who have lost their job, it's what they're feeling. And unfortunately, we have a president right now who does not care and who is incapable of leading. He is not up to the job. And I think that Pennsylvania is going to go in a different direction. And I think that not only are we going to do it, but I think we have to do it in a way that's overwhelming to send a historic message that Donald Trump's brand of division and hatred is not the America that we were aspiring to when we wrote all those documents here in Philadelphia. We've never lived up to it, but every generation has pushed us to make those words real, and this is our opportunity.
Malcolm, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That's Malcolm Kenyatta, state representative of Pennsylvania's 181st district here in Philadelphia, and one of the featured speakers at the Democratic National Convention that concluded last night. And joining us now is Erin Haynes. She's editor-at-large at the 19th. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom reporting on the intersection of gender, politics, and policy. Erin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. What a week.
What a week. And we will have a lot to talk about. Let me get Will Bunch in on the conversation as well. Will is a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Will, nice to have you with us on Radio Times once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Marty. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Well, let's start with how the convention did, what it looked like. It went from a piece of theater performed on a stage before a live audience to essentially a TV show with people watching at home. Aaron Haynes, what was your main takeaway about this? Was this a successful convention?
Well, you know, Marty, I think that this was a convention that really kind of maximized the moment that we're all in, right? I mean, everybody's kind of adjusting to Zoom life, and, and it was an unconventional convention that was happening mainly in our living rooms, which is where we've all settled into these past several months. And with that, you know, I think that really did kind of underscore the dual pandemics that we are in as a country, and I think that was a real focus of the convention this week, both the impact of the pandemic, you know, whether Americans have ever gotten sick or not, like yeah. Everybody is being impacted by this. And I think that many of the speakers kind of addressed that. And you had a lot of real people kind of talking about the impact of this moment in their lives and how they felt like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris could respond to that. But, you know, family was also really front and center. Joe Biden's family, obviously, last night, you saw that moving tribute to Beau Biden, but also people like, you know, Steph and Aisha Curry and their children. I mean, that really highlighting kind of the themes that bind us as Americans, getting beyond politics a bit. And then you had obviously some Democratic star power, Michelle yep. Obama, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Kamala Harris making history in the same week that we celebrated the suffrage centennial. And so, you know, I think that it was a fairly disciplined and on message convention, making the case for a Biden-Harris ticket, de-emphasizing President Trump kind of from a personal perspective and really kind of focused on the impact of his presidency on voters. You know, the three themes, and you talked about this kind of in the intro.
You know what, Aaron, hold on to that thought only because I'm looking at the clock and I want to get Will in before we have to take a break. And I want to pick up, Aaron, on some of the things that you just said there. But, Will, let me get your overall takeaway from the convention. And I read your piece this morning, and I think you, like a lot of people, were quite moved by the roll call and this sense of what America looked like. Or looks like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, my overall impression is, I mean, you know, the coronavirus caused us to speed up and kind of bring to its logical conclusion this trend that's been going on for about 50 years, which is taking conventions that used to be wide open and rowdy and democratic and turning them into very focused infomercials. And, you know, the fact that now that you're doing this virtually and not in a convention hall, right, made it possible to bring that all the way. I mean, the challenge for the Democrats was, could they make that entertain? If it's going to be an infomercial, is it going to be an entertaining one? And is it going to drive home a politically useful message? And I thought they did a remarkable job for something that's never been done before. I mean, they really stayed focused on this one word, empathy, you know, that Joe Biden has it and Donald Trump does it. And, you know, the message that America is a good place, that, you know, America, we're better than this. That yeah. was a phrase we heard a lot during the convention. And the roll call of the state moved me in a couple ways. One is...
Well, you know, Will, I've already interrupted my guest twice. We just got started. We just have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Will Bunch and Aaron Haynes about the Democratic National Convention that concluded last night. Much more to talk about after this very short break, and we've got some more clips as well. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we're talking about the Democratic National Convention, the virtual convention this week that concluded with the nomination of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to be the standard bearers for the party and to take on the Trump administration to President Trump and, of course, Vice President Mike Pence. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. If you watched, we want to know what you made of the convention, the speeches, the speakers, and what you think the message the party is sending out to voters. Aaron and Will, let me go back to you, but Aaron, let me start with you again. And the message, I mentioned this to Malcolm Kenyatta, which is the message from the party was was vote, 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 vote. And that just seems to be such a, I'm assuming the Republicans will do the same in their own way next week. But nonetheless, that seemed to be the strong message coming out of the convention. Erin?
Well, you know, I think it's an open question if that is what Republicans will be telling their viewers to do, is to vote like your life and the democracy depends on it. I think maybe we have heard a message, from this president, to vote or else, your way of life is in jeopardy. But expanding the vote has not really seemed to be a message that has been coming from the president or others in the Republican Party. I mean, look, not only did you constantly hear messages about kind of who Joe Biden is and really reiterating the theme of, you know, who are we as a country and that kind of being what this election is about. But yes, I mean, every few minutes it felt like you heard somebody just not only saying to vote and you know, text the Biden campaign to figure out, you know, how to come up with a plan to vote, but really vote in numbers that will make the results of this election unimpeachable, right? I mean, that was the other kind of takeaway that so many of the speakers had, and really putting it on not just the candidates, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but making it about the voters, making it about them and the power that they have as citizens of this country.
Well, let me go back to you. And I'm even thinking of the 2016 election, the convention, which was here in Philadelphia. We actually broadcast from there. And you were probably on the show 4 years ago talking about the Democratic Party. And it was, what we saw was, I don't know, behind the scenes, but certainly in front of the camera, was unity. How real do you think that is?
You mean the unity we saw in 2020? Because we didn't know
in 2020, yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, we didn't always see that in 2016, right? We saw Bernie Sanders delegates who got rowdy sometimes on the floor of the convention, and we had that famous moment where Sarah Silverman kind of admonished people to grow up and get behind the program, and the virtual convention eliminated the need for that. I think this plays off both your question and what Erin was saying. I think three important things we saw. Well, two things we saw going on, and one thing maybe we didn't see going on enough. There was a lot of an effort to peel off a small number of Republicans or undecideds or moderates who might be convincible, which is why you saw so many Republicans like Colin Powell and John Kasich getting some airtime. As you and Erin just discussed, I mean, there was a big emphasis on voting because, the real reason that Trump won and Hillary lost in 2016 was, minor setbacks in different voting blocks that didn't turn out enough, whether it was young people voting third party or whether it was African-Americans who didn't vote as enthusiastically for Hillary Clinton as they did for Obama. So the voting is obviously to try and bring those people home. I think where the convention failed a bit was in terms of unity is they could have done so much more to appeal to young voters, the further left, the people who tell pollsters that they're open to, a kind of socialism. There was a really interesting tweet that got a lot of play this morning from the kind of famous 80s punk rocker Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth, who is also an artist and a political commentator. She called the DNC quote decency porn unquote. In other words, that there was so much focus on empathy and those type issues that there was no discussion of in her mind. She said they should have said what they're going to do to help people losing their homes and their jobs. I think the DNC struggled both to talk about these very material concerns of young voters who can't pay their rent or who don't have a job or who are terrified about climate change. I mean, they did do a little riff on climate change, which was decent, but so there was that. And also just not giving enough attention to young voices in the party, between squeezing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez into 1 minute and then Julian Castro not speaking at all was also very popular with young voters, was just kind of mind-blowing. So to me, that was, I think, I think, kind of the biggest failure, because you need those people, you need young people to be enthusiastic, and you need them to vote really in better numbers than 2016. I mean, young voters don't like Trump. There is some motivation to turn out, but I think they also wanted a little bit more from Biden and the Democratic Party this week.
Aaron, it seemed that the Democratic Party was also saying we need Republicans, or we need Republicans who may have voted for Trump 4 years ago, but we want them back, or we want those Republicans who have soured on the president.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you did see them kind of making an appeal to a swath of the kind of coalition that I think they feel like they need to cobble together, for victory in November against an incumbent president in general, but this president in particular. And so reaching out to voters, particularly in states like Pennsylvania, that maybe had gone for Obama in 2008 and 2012, but then voted for Trump, trying to get some of those people back. I mean, if we get in the way back machine, Marty, it was, 2008, Joe Biden's addition to the Democratic ticket as vice president was because they thought, he had strength with white working class voters. And so playing up that part of his narrative, hearing from, folks who may have voted for Trump in 2016 and have changed their mind about that. But then also, trying to persuade voters who are trying to make a choice between voting for Joe Biden or staying home. Right. I mean, that is also a constituency that they feel like is in play. And because, again, larger thinking is that this is an election that potentially could be won on the margins, even though they're trying to say, let's run up the score. This could be a close election. And so, they see this as a kind of all hands on deck. And if that includes, getting folks like Cindy McCain, Colin Powell, John Kasich on board to make the case to those kinds of voters, it was certainly interesting to see them in the mix this week. I don't know that there will be an equivalent necessarily next week.
Hard to imagine. I kind of predict that there probably will not be. Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Erin Haynes. She's editor-at-large at the 19th. Joining us by Skype, Will Bunch is national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're talking about the Democratic National Convention concluded last night. We'll be doing the Republican Convention next Friday, and we want to hear from you, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're kind of bearing the lead here because there was a historic choice, Kamala Harris to be the vice presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. She spoke movingly about her family, specifically her mother. Let's just give a listen to about 45 seconds, and this is from Wednesday night.
My mother taught me that service to others gives life purpose and meaning. And oh, how I wish she were here tonight, but I know she's looking down on me from above. I keep thinking about that 25-year-old Indian woman, all of 5 feet tall, who gave birth to me at Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California. On that day, she probably could have never imagined that I would be standing before you now and speaking these words. I accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States of America.
Aaron, let me give you a chance to weigh in on that. I mean, this is the first woman of color. She's black. She's Indian, as she described there, who is running as vice president of the United States. Can you speak to this historic choice?
Yes. And Marty, I mean, absolutely. I'd be remiss not to point that out at being at a newsroom that represents conversation around women in politics. But Kamala Harris is actually the first black person to be nominated for vice president on a major party ticket. And we don't really say that part enough. Mm-hmm. But it did feel like a momentous night, even though, she was speaking to virtually an empty arena there. If we had been in person, there would have been thunderous applause, at the moment that she said that she was accepting that nomination. And so that was kind of surreal, but felt no less important or historic. Listen, Kamala Harris brought her full self to the stage that night, talking as the daughter of immigrants, the daughter of activists, an HBCU graduate, shouting out her historically black sorority, yeah. Talking about her history as a prosecutor, her role as Mamala, you know, to her two stepchildren, and really the pioneering politician that she has been and hopes to, and has already, you know, made history and hopes to make even more in November. It was just a night filled with symbolism and substance, and she was the climax of that, even as she also made the case for confronting systemic racism, addressing the coronavirus pandemic, and why Joe Biden should be the next president of the United States.
What does she bring to the ticket, Will?
You know, it was fascinating that when she was picked, a lot of commentators noted that it really spoke to the moment in 2020 that, she seems to be this radical choice in that, you know, she's the first woman of color. She's the first Asian American woman. And yet, in many ways, she was also the obvious choice, which is, I mean, it seems like a contradiction. But, you know, I mean, the entire Biden campaign has been about this idea that there's this big wide tent of people who are ready to vote Trump out of office and want to go, you know, want to restore, democratic values in this country. And so much of the Biden campaign is about doing what will make that tent as big as possible. And Kamala Harris, is a new kind of choice, but also, I mean, she really was the obvious choice because, not only are you speaking to people of color by making this historic selection, but when she ran for president, even though she struggled, she did have a lot of popularity among suburban women who really were what drove the party's comeback in the 2018 midterm elections. These people who kind of loosely build themselves as the resistance. She's very popular with that group. I mean, she's popular. She's fairly popular with, young people who were involved in the protests after the George Floyd moment. I mean, I do think it's interesting. I mean, I think before the murder of George Floyd and before the protests occurred, I think Biden was very open to choosing a white woman possibly, because I know he's very fond of Amy Klobuchar. He's been developing this relationship with Elizabeth Warren, but I think it just really spoke to the moment we've been having in 2020 that Kamala Harris was in the end kind of the perfect obvious choice. And I think you've seen that in the reaction to her so far.
Aaron, let me go back to you. I think you and I have talked about this. I know I've talked with other guests about the role that the black women play in the Democratic Party. Their loyalty and hard work has really been the backbone of the party in so many ways. We also saw her clash with Biden when they were on the stage together, running for the nomination, having to do with busing. Take that disagreement, that really very public argument that they had that felt kind of personal. Take that and help us understand what you think that did for Joe Biden.
Well, Marty, it's interesting. People's, I think, short-term memory is not always the best. If we go back to 2008, Joe Biden and Barack Obama didn't get off to the best start, right? I mean, he basically said that Barack Obama wasn't really qualified to be president when they were competing against each other in that primary. And then he ends up being Barack Obama's vice presidential pick, and they go on to have, this bromance that Democrats just loved. So, I think we know that there are kind of no permanent friends or enemies in politics, just permanent interests. And that relationship should have been a reminder of that to people, who were kind of hand-wringing over that debate exchange from last summer. But listen, I think Kamala Harris did kind of, as a primary candidate, keep race on the agenda for a lot of the candidates running for president, especially the white candidates who were having to address issues of privilege and inequality in this country even before this national reckoning on race. But to Will's point too, Kamala Harris was somebody who really was either at or near the top of the list in the Veep Stakes conversation for most of that process. Yeah, and that was as a result of the combination of her qualifications and lived experience, even as kind of the criteria for that role evolved over the course of this year. At the beginning of the year, so much of the focus on that was on, you know, energizing the base. But then obviously the pandemic hit and you needed somebody who was going to be kind of ready on day one to govern around a lot of those kinds of issues. You saw her being responsive to marginalized communities in the pandemic as a senator. But then, you know, with systemic racism really coming into bigger focus, somebody who would also be able to respond on day one to that and to really be a compliment to Joe Biden, who launched his campaign talking about this election being about a battle for the soul of America. And so, you know, really, despite those, you know, kind of criteria shifting, Kamala Harris was somebody who, you know, apparently continued to check all the boxes for Joe Biden, and their you know, rift last summer was not a deal breaker for him, clearly.
Well, let me just quote two lines from what she said on Wednesday night. One, I know a predator when I see one, and I'm taking that slightly out of context, but I think yeah. we know what she's saying there. She also said there is no vaccine for racism, and again, she has been very critical of the president and our vice presidents, and do you think she will be that so-called attack dog?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because that was exactly the point I wanted to make about her. And you know, I think one reason people so quickly or easily, you know, so easily can move on from that exchange that she had with Biden during the debates is because it showed she's you know, a savvy political player who will do what she has to do to try and win. I mean, in that case, it didn't. I mean, it did work briefly. I mean, it gave her a big bump in the polls for a week or two. You're right. I mean, you know, for the vice president. I mean, obviously, like Aaron said, I mean, this is a different year, and there's more of a focus on, and also because of Biden's age, there's more of a focus on her ability to step into the job. But at the end of the day, the short-term role of the vice presidential candidate is to be that pit bull, right, to go after Trump, to goad him. And part of the reason for that is because it allows Biden to stay above the fray, which is, you know, what you saw Biden doing in his acceptance speech last night, right, when he's talking about, you know, going into the light and out of the darkness. You know, he can focus on those loftier themes because he's got...
Well, we got to take a very short break. I interrupted you again, and we will be right back. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Erin Haynes. She is editor-at-large at the 19th. Also with us, Will Bunch. He's national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We are discussing and dissecting the Democratic National Convention concluded last night with the selection this week of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to be their presidential and vice presidential nominees for this election season. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. I know we have a lot more to say. Let me read some comments, and then I want to set up a clip from what President Obama said earlier this week. First of all, Thomas says all convention speakers tend to preach to the converted. Comment from Dave, I watched most of the convention. It was all about Trump and not much about Democratic Party's platform. As such, it looks like both conventions will be all about Trump. A comment from Tierra, I watched almost all of the DNC. Neither Joe or Kamala was my choice for president, but I will vote for them. I'm willing to forgive them for their bad past decisions since we all make mistakes, and goes on from there. Let me play a clip, and this was from earlier in the week. This is President Obama, who was, I would say, almost out of character in his pointed and personal criticisms of President Trump. And this is a speech that came as part of the Democratic National Convention on Wednesday night.
I never expected that my successor would embrace my vision or continue my policies. I did hope, for the sake of our country, that Donald Trump might show some interest in taking the job seriously, that he might come to feel the weight of the office and discover some reverence for the democracy that had been placed in his care. But he never did. For close to 4 years now, he has shown no interest in putting in the work, no interest in finding common ground, no interest in using the awesome power of his office to help anyone but himself and his friends. No interest in treating the presidency as anything but one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves.
Aaron, I mentioned that that's sort of unusual for former President Obama. It seems also unusual for a former president to be so critical of a sitting president. What did you make of the message that Obama was sending out?
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, Marty, this is a president who has largely not, been critical of his successor over these past 4 years, but seems to be now speaking out and speaking to what he feels is the urgency of the moment. And that's something that he kind of has been increasingly wading into as we've gotten through primary season and headed into the general election. And he also has been talking so much about the urgency of voting, in eulogizing Congressman John Lewis last month, was very emotional about the need for Americans, and particularly Black Americans, who may be balancing the threat of the pandemic with their access to the ballot box, really underscoring that point. But I think that what we also did see yesterday, Marty, he was at the Museum of the American Revolution here in Philadelphia.
Yep.
You had a constitutional law professor behaving like a constitutional law professor in giving that speech and really talking about the stakes of this democracy and framing this election in those terms, even as he was talking about kind of his relationship to Joe Biden and why he thought, that voters should choose him as the next president. So, yes, I think it was kind of uncharacteristic in terms of former President Obama's tone and his direct attack on President Trump. But in some ways, I think you did see kind of some classic Obama, in that setting.
Well, Will, just to quote another couple of lines from what Obama said about the president, that he hasn't grown in the job. And then he adds, because he can't. What did you make of what Obama said?
I thought it was fascinating. And I heard this from several of the speakers over the course of the week, in that it was an attack on Trump, obviously, but it was an attack kind of laced with pity. You know, it wasn't mean or cruel. It was like, gee, we really hope this. We knew there were concerns about this guy, but we really hope that in spite of those, he would rise to the moment. And isn't it a shame that he just doesn't have him? It was in him. It was kind of a pity fest, and I think a couple of things like that. I mean, I think they thought that was a message. You know, it's interesting. I just, for various reasons, I saw clips over the course of the week from old Democratic conventions, like when, Ann Richards speaking about George H.W. Bush back in 1988. And,
it was the silver foot in his mouth.
Right. And it's a silver spoon in his foot. Right. And it was much more harsh than acerbic than what you heard about Trump, that they were trying to pity him. And I think, I think that was the tone they were going for. They didn't want to come off as being, too mean. Really, if they hadn't had, the comedian Julia Louis-Dreyfus last night making some cutting jokes about Trump, you would have really heard almost none of that during the 4 days. And I think the thing is, nothing can drive people more crazy than telling them that you pity them, right? So, they're still getting under Trump's skin and causing him to go on these tweet storms and go crazy without looking mean themselves. So I thought it was pretty well played. More broadly, the reason people like Obama or Hillary Clinton and people like that spoke out in the terms they did is because I do think they really feel that the threat to American democracy is significant and it's real. And if you feel that way, how could you not speak out in the and issue the strongest possible warning that you can. I mean, it's an obligation, really, and I think that's what they were trying to fulfill.
Well, let me play one more clip, and this is former First Lady Michelle Obama. She gave a speech at the convention earlier in this week, and one of the descriptions that I read time and time again was her kind of moral outrage about what she observes going on in the country. Let me play that, and then, Aaron, I'll give you a chance to respond.
Sadly, this is the America that is on display for the next generation. A nation that's underperforming not simply on matters of policy, but on matters of character. And that's not just disappointing, it's downright infuriating. Because I know the goodness and the grace that is out there in households and neighborhoods all across this nation. And I know that regardless of our race, age, religion, or politics, when we close out the noise and the fear and truly open our hearts, we know that what's going on in this country is just not right.
Let me go back to you, Aaron, and just to add one thing, having read Michelle Obama's memoir, but also things that she has said, that she found it just really unforgivable that Donald Trump essentially endangered her family with his birther-based racism. I sometimes feel like with partners, it's the partner of the person who's been attacked who's the most angry and wants the most kind of revenge, if you will. Speak to what you think Michelle Obama was saying.
I think what she was saying was she said it in her speech. You know, I hate politics, but I love this country, and that really is what has compelled her to wade into this year's election. I mean, she's somebody who, you know, has an organization that's mainly focused on voting, right? And so she has been, trying to get people registered and turned out, but has not really waded into the politics of 2020 until now. But boy, did she ever, this week. And it's interesting that you bring up the memoir because, you know, Becoming was released, I think, a week after the midterms in 2018 and was a bestseller within a week. Within 15 days, it was the best-selling book of the year. And so you have 11 million copies of that book sold, a sold-out book tour that was more like a rock concert, a podcast and a documentary. These are all people, and I wrote about this week, who could be mobilized in November into voters based on their very strong connection to her through her narrative, right? This is somebody that people trust regardless of their politics, across age, across racial lines. Michelle Obama really could turn out what I'm calling the becoming vote in November. And even if she never says anything else between, you know, now and the next 11 weeks, about President Trump or politics in general, I think what she said this week is something that resonated potentially with a lot of people who really have an affinity for her and a trust in her and will listen to what she has to say and act on that.
Let me read a comment from Jess. And Will, this is something that you had mentioned earlier. Jess says, Andrea Ocasio-Cortez is very popular. Why does the Democratic Party seem to try to brush her off? She is certainly more popular with Democrats than John Kasich. He got obviously more time at the convention. I say obviously only because it was obvious that he got more time if you watched it. What do you make of that? And he was rather critical and dismissive of her in some comments he made.
Yeah, he did. Kasich, I think, in an interview described AOC as a publicity seeker, you know, and somebody who wasn't really a true voice of the party, which is, you know, how would Republican John Kasich know he's a true voice of the Democratic Party, right? But, yeah, the Democratic Party has this remarkable young group of very progressive people who are on the rise, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the best known and kind of the leader of the group. But you have Rashida Tlaib, and you have people who are likely to win in November like Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush in St. Louis and some of these other folks. And these people are winning upset victories because they really appeal to a rising tide in the electorate of young people and people who are, you know, tired of the economic inequality in this country, tired of, systemic racism in this country, and they really want major change. And, that message, which has been so front and center in so many ways in 2020, was really downplayed in this convention. Strategically, you can perhaps understand why. I mean, that's what the Trump campaign wants to have as a foil to some degree, the ability to say that this is too far left, that this is too radical for America. And so, I think that the Biden people and the people running the convention didn't want to wave that red flag in front of Trump and, you know, in front of these Republican possibly convincible voters that they were trying to convince with John Kasich and Cindy McCain. So, but I think it was unfortunate. I mean, that, like I said before, I mean, there's a risk of young voters not voting or, you know, luckily for the Democrats, there's not a real prominent third party option this year, but, there's a risk of folks staying home. And that was the difference in 2016 when you really look at the numbers.
Aaron, we have just a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. Were there other moments from the convention that you think were noteworthy or newsworthy?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Hillary Clinton's speech really, I think, was a reminder for folks. I mean, it was a night where women were kind of on full display. It was the day after the centennial of suffrage and really kind of focusing and reflecting on the power of women in this democracy. And then to have Hillary Clinton kind of up there reminding people of the stakes and what can happen if people don't show up. She said, you know, this can't be a woulda, coulda, shoulda election this year. And I think that is something that is on a lot of Democratic voters' minds headed into November. So I thought that her speech was definitely also one of the big ones of the week.
How about for you, Will?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about a lot is I think the Democrats made incredibly effective use of everyday people. Particularly the woman, and unfortunately I'm forgetting her name, but the woman who unfortunately lost her father to the coronavirus.
Yeah.
And said that my dad had one pre-existing condition, which was he trusted Donald Trump. She was very effective. I don't know if we've mentioned the 13-year-old boy with the stuttering problem last night.
I just scribbled that down, yep.
And the 11-year-old girl who had the immigrant mom who had to leave the country.
Yeah, and you can actually point to five or six of these. And it's not a new thing. I mean, we've seen, you know, in the old-fashioned convention hall type conventions, we've seen everyday people speak. But you know, I think this kind of telethon style format of the virtual convention gives a little bit more power and weight to these like everyday testimonials. And I think the Democrats really nailed it. Some of these everyday people were just as memorable as the celebrities who keynoted the four nights of the convention.
I think we're almost out of time here. Was it Rhode Island, Will, and the guy with the plate of was it calamari or something?
But
it was charming.
We all laugh at the calamari, but Americans after this horrific year that's still ongoing want to feel good about this country, right? And I think if there is any overriding goal of the Democrats was to tap into that sense of give us some hope, give us something to feel good about. And, you know, if it takes something as silly as calamari, do it, then bring it on. Because, you know, I mean, that roll call, as we were talking earlier, I mean, that just opened up kind of the big blue sky and the mountains and the beaches. And in a year when we're, you know, claustrophobically stuck in our homes.
It's a big country.
It opened up America.
I agree. And I was laughing because it just warmed my heart, frankly, to see all those Americans who still seem to believe in the country. Will Bunch, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much, Marty.
You're welcome. And Aaron Haynes, thank you very much as well.
Good to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aarons, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.